Today in Studio 360, when a president has an affair with a White House intern, who are you going to call? On the new network drama Scandal, that would be Kerry Washington. She plays a fixer specializing in VIP damage control.
All kinds of information about you would easily become available to the press. For example, you've had 22 sexual partners that we know of. Also, there's that ugly bout of gonorrhea.
You're so mean.
I was thinking the same thing.
Later, we visit some of the mean streets of New Orleans, where a new rap group's trying to clean up the dirty South.
I can't say it's conscious or it's positive. It's just, yeah, it's just real. It's life. It's not romanticized.
Plus, the high-stakes legal battle that's roiling the culture industry. Appropriation by a famous artist? A federal judge calls it stealing. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by the Vilcek Foundation, dedicated to raising awareness of immigrant contributions to the arts and sciences, congratulating the winners of the 2012 Vilcek Prizes, Carlos Bustamante in biomedical science, and Mikhail Baryshnikov in dance. More info at vilcek.org.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I don't know much about fashion, but even I noticed Michelle Obama's dress at the inauguration 3 years ago. In that sea of conventional dark suits, the First Lady was actually chic in this chartreuse lace dress and matching overcoat.
I thought of it as a character in a painting. It was all about the color for me. What could I dress her on that she can pop out and she can carry the emotion that the whole country was feeling, which was that optimism.
That is the dress's designer, Isabel Toledo, who became a mass market fashion celebrity almost overnight. Later this hour, I'll drop by her beautiful and charming studio in New York. But first, we're going to talk about a lawsuit that has huge implications for how art can be legally made. Possibly a landmark case. It's about artists who incorporate other people's work into their own, what's known as appropriation. The artist Richard Prince has built his career on appropriation, reproducing all kinds of pop culture, and his work has sold for millions of dollars apiece. The lawsuit concerns Prince's use of dozens of Patrick Carreyrou's photos of Rastafarians as the basis for paintings. Prince dabbed on a little paint here and there, changing the photographic images just slightly. So Patrick Carreyrou sued Richard Prince for copyright infringement, and last year, a federal judge in New York City ruled in favor of Carreyrou. His case is on appeal, and the art world is on edge, waiting to see if what a lot of artists do these days is about to become illegal. We've got two guests here to talk about art appropriation and what this case might mean. Michael Ripps is an attorney who represented the superstar artist Jeff Koons in a very similar case back in the 1990s. And the artist Penelope Umbrico uses appropriated photographs all the time in her work. Michael, Penelope, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, Michael, here we have a case of one working professional photographer who wants damages from this multimillionaire art star for using his work. Can we look at this through the lens of your Jeff Koons case, which was decided against your client?
Yes, absolutely. Koons saw a postcard of a couple sitting in the countryside on a bench, and they were holding a group of puppies. Koons sends it off to sculptors in Italy who render a life-size depiction of that scene. Yeah. At the end of the day, however much you appropriate, whatever you're commenting on, before you can have a copyright violation, you have to show damages. In the Koons case, we argued the idea that Koons was selling into an entirely different, impregnable market, impregnable to the artist from whom he borrowed, than was the artist himself. The photographer in Koons was selling, you know, sentimental postcards in airports.
Right. So in this case, while Carreyrou, the photographer, may be angry and feel resentful naturally, understandably, that Richard Prince is selling paintings for millions of dollars and his photographs sell for presumably hundreds of dollars, if there's no damage to his work and job as a photographer, he doesn't get damages?
Precisely. And take the Duchamp case. Take the urinal, right? He took that urinal, wholesale appropriation of the urinal, put it in an art gallery. So to what extent has Duchamp's urinal infringed or hurt the market for the urinal company's urinals?
Right. Zero.
Answer, zero.
But it seems as though there are very different standards and protocols for fair use in different media. For instance, I was just required to pay hundreds of dollars for a couple of lines from each of two pop songs that I incorporated into this novel I'm about to publish. Why, for instance, didn't Richard Prince just say, go to Carrieu and say, I like your photographs, I want to pay you something, and use them?
Well, I think the notion of recontextualization is really important. And in terms of the example of the urinal, that recontextualization is really clear because the urinal is not an authored object. It's a manufactured object,
right.
Mass-produced, and there is no author we can say is attributed.
Mr. Crane is not taking responsibility.
Yeah. Right.
Your work appropriates photography in significant, vast ways, most of it. For instance, photographs posted by people you don't know on Flickr you've incorporated mm-hmm. into your work. Describe what you do to that and why you regard that as fair play.
Well, first of all, those photographs that the Flickr project is pictures of sunsets. I'm not taking the whole entire photograph. I'm only taking the sun. So it's such a small fragment. It goes into that category of fair use. But the question I think you originally asked was, why wouldn't I go to every single one of the people that I've used their photographs of and ask them if I can use a part of their photograph for my work? There are more than 10 million sunset photographs that kind of look
right.
all the same.
Right.
So there's something really beautiful about that we all do this thing. And so to ascribe an individual authorship in the original photograph is actually to undermine the whole project.
What if somebody borrowed your photograph wholesale, republishes your photograph in a gallery or a book, and claims that they're just using that photograph in order to demonstrate, comment on the ubiquity of appropriationist art in the beginning of the 21st
it's
century.
It's happened, actually.
Happened.
So, yeah.
And you have no objection to that.
No, I mean, I feel like this is not a new thing, appropriation. We all come up in a world of influences.
But it's new in its extent and sort of overtness,
yeah,
I guess.
Right. No, I actually, grew up looking at Prince, and I really love some of his work, and some of it I'm not that excited about. And
so you could say it's mediocre and he's a charlatan, but it ought to be legal.
Yeah, and it's kind of too bad in a way that...
But why should it be legal if he is a charlatan? I mean, if he is using the aesthetics of that photograph, the formal arrangement from the photograph, and he's essentially using that to sell his own work.
He's using that as an aesthetic device in his work. His work sells without that.
Right.
So, I don't think he is being a charlatan. I'm not sure the work is that interesting. I don't know. I actually didn't see the show, so I feel bad about even, I wanted to see it.
It's lazy,
yeah.
though, as an artist.
No, I don't think it's lazy, actually. I think there's a kind of mental gymnastics that's interesting about it.
If you were in his position, I mean, what would be wrong with, say, hiring an assistant with your many millions of dollars and saying, go down to Jamaica, take some pictures of Rastas, bring them back to me, and I'm going to make some pictures out of them. Isn't that essentially what he's doing, except he's just taken the pictures somebody else has published?
He is not interested in authoring images. He's interested in making paintings and employing images to be active inside the frame of his paintings. So for him to go and make the images changes the dynamics of his paintings, actually.
If this ruling stands, Penelope, and Prince loses his appeal, will that change the way you work?
No. It'll make me even more adamant about working this way. It's just so annoying that could be the possible outcome.
And Michael, if the case stands, are you going to get more clients and more work among artists, do you think?
Most likely.
Penelope Umbrico, Michael Ripps, thank you both very much.
Kurt Anderson, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Michael Ripps is a lawyer and author. Penelope Umbrico is a photographer and artist. At studio360.org, you can see some of the images and photos we were talking about. And while you're there, give us your take. When should freely appropriating another artist's work be allowed and when not?
She was more like a beauty queen with an M16. I said, oh, my, but when do you mean I?
A couple of weeks ago, we kicked off a short story contest inspired by a new book called Significant Objects. We picked up three items at a thrift shop and then asked you to pick one of them and fill in the blanks. We're looking for the object's backstory, a short piece of fiction, poetry, a comic, whatever. You can go to our website and post your entry there. We've already got over 100 submissions.
Hi, this is Nina from Astoria, Queens, and I chose to write about the wooden thing. I pick up the little wooden thing and move the trapdoor, and there's a penny under it. It's a magic trick, says Ella, and she grabs it from my hand. Look, I can make the penny disappear. And she does. My mouth is open wide. How? Grandpa was a magician. He'd never want me to tell you, she says.
Hi, this is Mark. I'm from Freehold, New Jersey. Dad didn't smoke Marlboro. He smoked unfiltered Camels. And he didn't die of lung cancer, but he's still dead. He's gone over 30 years, and every time I see this frickin' thing, memories of him swarm over me like maggots on bad meat.
There is still time to enter, but not much. The deadline's April 8th. That's Sunday at midnight Eastern Time. Go to studio360.org for all the details. Coming up, New Orleans hip-hop is known for a tough sound called gangsta gumbo. But some local MCs are sick of it.
You can get 25 to L, you can get lethal injection, you can lose family members. They don't tell you those type of things. They just speak about the grind and the hustle part of it. You know what
this is. Can the Dirty South clean up its act? That, plus the actress Kerry Washington, are all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Yeah, all I have in this world is a pistol and a primers, a fist full of dollars, a list full of problems. I dress them like P.O. boxes. Yeah, I'm from New Orleans, the Creole cockpit. We so out of it, zero tolerance, gangsta gumbo. I serve them a pot of it. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Over the last decade, the actress Kerry Washington has become well known for her terrific performances in movies like The Last King of Scotland and Ray. But now she's the star of her own new network series, which even today is a rare feat for an African-American woman. It's called Scandal. Washington plays Olivia Pope, a D.C. lawyer slash media consultant slash super fixer who makes clients' problems, their scandals, go away. In the first episode, a young Marine Corps hero and Republican politician is suspected of murdering his girlfriend. To buy him a little time, she drops by the home of her contact at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
He didn't kill her. My gut says he didn't.
Your spidey senses aren't evidence. I've been on the phone with homicide. He killed her and ran.
I can have a reporter out here in 20 minutes with cameras asking why you're persecuting an innocent handicapped Medal of Honor winner. Perhaps because he's a well-known conservative Republican and you are considering a bid on the Democratic ticket next year. Just to be clear, that was me threatening you.
Yeah, until morning.
36 hours.
24
hours. Pleasure to see you again.
The show is actually inspired by a real-life woman named Judy Smith who does this work. And while the personal life of Olivia Pope is far more complicated than Judy's personal life, Judy used to work in the White House. She worked in the first Bush White House. And you never know who's going to walk in the door because crisis management is, you know, we can handle a crisis whether it has to do with somebody in sports or entertainment or a politician or a union or a CEO. I mean, her client list spans the spectrum.
As you say, she's represented people like Monica Lewinsky, Michael Vick, mm-hmm. also Larry Craig, the anti-gay rights senator who was arrested in the Minneapolis airport bathroom.
Tapping his feet around.
Uh-huh. Had a wide stance,
yes,
as I recall.
Yes, that's correct.
Your character has iffy clients who aren't necessarily easy either for that character or the audience to immediately identify with. And she herself, interestingly, kind of bends the rules, threatens people, as we heard in that clip opening with media exposure. I want to play another clip where she becomes even harder to love in a conventional way. You're talking to a young woman who's alleging that she had an affair with the president for whom she's worked.
Amanda, it would be a mistake to think there will be no consequences to you telling lies about the president.
How do you know my name? Who are you?
My name is Olivia Pope, and I want to be clear, I'm not here in any official capacity. I'm only here to warn you because you should know what could happen. It could become hard for you to find employment. Your face would be everywhere. People would associate you with a sex scandal. All kinds of information about you would easily become available to the press. For example, you've had 22 sexual partners that we know of. Also, there's that ugly bout of gonorrhea. And your family, your mother's mental illness, a psychotic break, 2 years at Bedford Hospital. I bet that's private. She runs a daycare now, right?
He told me he loved me. He gave me this dog.
See, it's those kind of lies that could hurt you if you said them to other people, people not as nice as me. I'll give you some free advice. Hand in your resignation, then pack up your dog and your things, get in your car and go. Find a small city, Minneapolis maybe, or Denver. Get a little job, meet a boring boy, make some friends. Because in this town, your career is over. You're done.
Why are you doing this to me? I'm a good person.
You know who else was a good person? Monica Lewinsky. And she was telling the truth, but she still got destroyed.
You're so mean.
I was thinking the same thing.
Wow.
You know, I think what's really interesting, though, is that I think when Olivia does stuff like that, she's not lying. You know, she's actually always saying, this is what could happen, and I'm trying to make the situation better for everyone involved. It could be worse for this girl if she sticks around and... Yeah.
But is the big idea for the show that even a good guy, which you are in this program, has to sometimes do morally questionable things to be good?
I think actually the big idea is that people are complicated and that human beings are complex and messy, and that seldom in life is the good guy all good and the bad guy all bad. And I think one of the things that Olivia's committed to is the idea that everybody deserves a shot.
Yeah, and it's so relatively rare in entertainment and on television to have the grays, the moral ambiguities, so kind of foregrounded as you're doing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun for me because in her personal life, she is much more torn and confused and is not so clear and put together. So even that for me as an actor is really fun to think about, who is this person who, like so many of us, has one performance that they show to the world and a very different identity behind closed doors.
Although you're perfectly put together in all phases of your life, aren't you?
Kerry Washington, absolutely. But,
yeah,
you know, Olivia is...
No issues, no weirdness,
never.
Right?
No, and lots of therapy bills to prove it.
I missed Ray, in which you became a movie star when it first came out. But then I watched The Last King of Scotland, having never heard of you, not knowing you. You played Kay, one of Idi Amin's wives, who falls in love with and gets pregnant by this young Scottish doctor played by James McAvoy. I was utterly blown away by your performance, and I want to play a little bit of what blew me away.
I have to get it out of me. He will kill me, Nicholas. I have to get it out. What are we going to do?
Hello.
I want you to do it. Please. You are a doctor. I know you can do it. I know you can do it,
no,
Nicholas.
No, we can't. I can't do that. This isn't some simple procedure. It has to be done under clinical conditions.
If you don't do something now, I'm going to have to find a place to go. I'm going to have to get it done in one of the villages. Is that what you want,
no,
Nicholas?
No, you don't. Come here. Whatever you do, you don't do that. Right. I'm going to sort something out. Just promise me you'll stay in the house. Please promise me you'll stay in the house.
Promise me this is going to be all right.
I promise. We'll do it first thing in the morning.
That's James McAvoy and Kerry Washington in the great film The Last King of Scotland. I watched that. I thought, wow, who is this great African actress they've gotten? Honestly, what kind of research or vocal coaching or whatever did you have to do that?
Forest Whitaker and I worked with the same accent coach in Los Angeles before we left for Uganda. And that was really helpful because being that in real life, Kay Amin and Idi Amin were from the same tribe in Uganda, uh-huh. We wanted to kind of have the same approach to learning the accent. And I'd never been to the continent of Africa before. And There's this very complicated negotiation that you have as an African-American going back. Even the fact that I would say going
sure.
back. Going.
Yes.
I think I had always been really intimidated by navigating what that would be like for me. And so I had never been. And going with the job of just saying, you know, none of that matters. Your job is to get off the plane and just be an African gave me a real freedom to just embrace this culture and this identity.
You grew up in New York City in the Bronx at a moment when the Bronx was synonymous with urban decay and failure, mm-hmm. bonfire of the vanities.
Mm-hmm.
But your life was not particularly difficult or squalid, was it?
I think a big part, if I'm honest with myself, a big part of why I'm fascinated by seeing the ways that our socioeconomics and our cultural background influence who we are psychologically, I think all of that has to do with the fact that from a very young age, from the age of 11, I started commuting from the Bronx to the Upper East Side because I went to a private school in Manhattan called Spence. And
which is like the gossip girliest private school in Manhattan, essentially.
I wouldn't say that, but it is one of those schools that, in that inter-school world.
Yeah.
I from a very young age had to start navigating the difference between, you know, what my community looked like at 7 in the morning and what my community looked like at 7 at night. And I, you know, had parents that really encouraged me to feel at home in both places and to learn how to be kind of bicultural, if you will.
And your parents were both were successful middle-class people.
Yeah, working middle-class. My mom's a retired professor. My dad's a real estate broker.
So you never, as an adolescent, had this sense of, oh, I have to be this way on the east side. I can be this way at home? Or were you just...
No, I mean, I do think... I mean, even to this day, you can tell when I've been on the phone with my cousins from the Bronx. You know, there's a different kind of musicality to the way I'm talking when I'm with
right.
them. So there are little ways that I would, you know, kind of be at home in different places. But I think that the kind of core values of who I was remained consistent.
Kerry Washington, thanks so much.
It's such a delight. I'm so glad we could finally do this.
Me too. Kerry Washington is the star of the new ABC drama Scandal, which airs on Thursday night. For most of us, New Orleans is the birthplace of jazz, the home of Fats Domino, Alan Toussaint, Dr. John. But for the last 15 years or so, New Orleans' most influential music has been hip-hop. Hardcore rappers and their woozy celebrations of the ghetto have made New Orleans the epicenter of the musical style known as Dirty South. But now a group of young New Orleans MCs are bucking that trend, trying to prove that there's more to rap about than homicides and bling. Alec Hamilton has the story.
I'm in New Orleans, the city I love the most, the city where my home is, and where the people I still call my neighbors live, even though I moved away 2 years ago. In my 8 years living here, I had teenagers, just kids, really, with guns, rob me for $3 or my bike. Some of my friends got really hurt. Some got killed. The murder rate here is 10 times the national average.
Oh, the violence here is amazing to me. You know, like, it's Man, I don't really even have words for it. It's just horrible. It really is. But that's New Orleans, sadly.
That's 20-year-old rapper Chels. Because of Hurricane Katrina, she now lives in Baton Rouge. But she comes back on the weekends to record and perform with her up-and-coming rap group, New Renaissance.
Once for higher learning, I'm a new age, comedic queen, new sages, new pages, written on what have you dreamed. Two haters, reading from the newspapers of New Orleans, murder, 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 all they know and all they see.
New Renaissance is made up of five MCs, barely out of their teens. Yet their sound is a throwback to the jazzy beats and conscious rhymes of late 80s, early 90s hip-hop. It's very different from the grimy sound of the Dirty South. But it's not just their sound that sets them apart. It's also their message.
I say it's real music. It's just real. It's honesty. You know, I can't, you know, put a certain genre on it. I can't say it's conscious or it's positive. It's just, yeah, it's just real. It's life. It's not romanticized.
But then I gave myself a check. Only thing I need is my self-respect.
That's Mid-City AB, another rapper from New Renaissance. Not long ago, I caught a ride with him and Chels as they drove across town to meet the rest of the group at the recording studio.
Coming up in my street, very next street up. This used to be a school, Fitz Howard. They knocked it down last year. Empty lot now, just sitting there.
New Renaissance isn't alone in going the conscious rap route. But until lately, to find a really well-known positive rap song from New Orleans, you had to go back a couple of decades.
There once was a kid who lived in poverty, with the urge to make some real fast money. He needed a job and to get one he tried, but everywhere that he applied he wasn't qualified.
My name is Dion Norman, professionally known as Devious. I am a New Orleans rap artist, and I have been recording music for 20 years. I started in 89 and my first record was a positive record. It was called Street Life. Baby T and Manny Fresh made the track. And it was a record about a young guy getting caught up in the drug game and ended up seeing his family members die. And then he ended up having to retaliate. And then he ended up dying. It was a big hit.
I'm not saying the dope is wrong or right. I'm only telling you about the raw street life.
But Devious didn't just rap about violence. He also warned of the consequences.
You know, they don't tell you, okay, you can get 25 to L, you can get lethal injection, you can lose family members, you can make a contribution to genocide. They don't tell you those type of things. They just speak about the grind and the hustle part of it.
So why do you think so much of the sound coming out of New Orleans over the last 10 years or so, I mean, it seems like a lot of it really accepted and even kind of praised that kind of life?
Because that's a product of our environment. New Orleans roots for the bad guy. You know, it's always been that way. New Orleans is a city that roots for the bad guy.
That's Manny Fresh. Manny is hip-hop royalty in this town. He's been around long enough to work with Devious D and see the Dirty South blow up nationally. First, there was Master P's No Limit label in the early 90s, and then the aptly named Cash Money Records. It featured artists like Juvenile, BG, and Lil Wayne, often rapping over Manny's beats. That's Manny on his own track, Real Big.
Is that a fish tank, bro, in the middle of the dash? Yeah, pimper, don't put your fingers on my glass.
Cash Money became known for a swaggering sound that Lil Wayne called gangsta gumbo. But now, Manny says much of it was misunderstood.
A lot of these so-called dudes that you think are the thugs or whatever, they just ghetto authors, they ghetto poets, you know what I'm saying? They cool at what they do, but don't imitate what they saying or whatever. Don't go buy a gun and kill nobody. Like, you know, you got a lot of rappers who say, well, I'm selling out if I tell you that. Well, you might be saving a life if you tell a kid that, because they're impressionable.
Well, 10 years ago, I was loving that. I was loving Cash Money, No Limit. I thought that was life.
AB was barely 10 years old then.
I was standing in front of that TV all day just staring at it. That wasn't hip-hop at all, though. That's stunting, just like they said. That's stunting. That's stunting is when you showing, you like, yeah, I got this easy. I'm saying, I'm driving this car, this easy. Like, you know, I'm holding up my jewelry and all that, but I ain't showing, you know, the bad stuff, the dark side.
At one point during the interview, a police car passes us slowly. A minute later, it passes us again. I see the officer eyeing us suspiciously, and that's when I realize he's probably looking at the mic I'm pointing at AB.
You think those police think I've got a gun?
They probably, they might. They might. Or maybe they just the patrol, because it's like, you know, it's hot around there. Like, he might be talking in a dispatcher or whatnot, but we cool. Especially because y'all are white. Especially because.
Once we arrive at the studio, we meet up with B-Mike, a former teacher who produces rap videos and is the group's unofficial mentor. He's joined by fellow MCs Super Creative and LG. But the fifth member of the group, who goes by the name Cypher, is missing.
Well, it won't be five, because Sife said he don't want to get on it.
He don't want to.
Y'all gonna have to talk to that brother. I don't know.
B-Mike's not sure why Sypha suddenly bailed on the group, but he thinks maybe New Renaissance didn't fit his image.
I think he was talking about the entire thing in general, like the whole
positive.
Yeah, the Renaissance idea.
Yeah, I hate
that. It's not, like, see, because you don't, that's why you can't use it. Don't use it.
I tell you, when you just keep it real, though. Like, that's my whole thing. Like, it could be whatever. Like, I'm going to just keep it real. Now, it's going to be like that verse going to get cut or not. But I'm just keep it real. They say no cussing. They say, you know what I'm saying, nobody get killed. You want to highlight the city, the positive things. I've been there 21 years. They got some good things I could talk about from the city, you know.
And they got some bad things I could talk about.
They got some bad things, but that's not on this record.
But here's the challenge. Talking about this stuff and selling it are two different things. New Renaissance's first video has 18,000 views on YouTube, which is not a lot for a rap single. Then again, if you look at the comments, people are really moved by what these guys are trying to do, including Manny Fresh, the former Cash Money kingmaker, who did as much as anyone to keep Southern rap dirty.
In the city where we're from, New Orleans, like, you definitely need positive role models. Like, you know, and I commend them on that, their bravery and everything for doing what they do. Because it's like, I mean, we from a crazy place.
He even produced the beat that the group is rapping on today.
New Orleans, baby! Get them!
It definitely gives us the credibility because people see Manny Fresh and they see us and like, okay, must be something good if he's associated, you know, so it's definitely helping us.
B-Mike says New Renaissance is quietly getting support from other rappers, too.
They understand. They're like, I'm happy y'all doing this because I might not be able to directly come out and say these things or directly come out and change my image to do this, but I'm happy somebody is and I want to support y'all.
Later I found out that Cypha, who was missing earlier, rejoined the group. It was sort of a misunderstanding. He wasn't being negative about being positive. He just didn't think the new track was his style. So for now, New Renaissance and their message is intact.
We want better. Like, bottom line, I want better. For myself and for my people.
There's always going to be violence, but I will say this. Hopefully they'll take what I'm saying and just listen to it. And hopefully I'll be, you know, make some sort of difference. You never know. Never really know.
You never really know. But for them, for my neighbors in New Orleans, for myself, I really hope they do. For Studio 360, I'm Alec Hamilton.
And that's the new track called Freedom Land 2 from the rap group New Renaissance. You can see one of their music videos at studio360.org. Coming up, a young, shy kid from Mexico moves to Los Angeles and finds a new friend inside a Kiss album.
It said, I can see you from the corners of my eyes, and I know what you do when the lights go out. Instead of being frightened by it, I was actually really comforted by it.
That, plus fashion designer Isabel Toledo, all just ahead. You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
The Toledos?
Isabel Toledo is not quite a household name, but she has quietly become one of the most respected, beloved, and sought-after fashion designers in the business. And she's just published a book explaining it all. Part memoir, part how-to. It's called Roots of Style. A couple of weeks ago, at their studio in Manhattan, I visited Toledo and her husband and professional partner, the illustrator Ruben Toledo.
Hi.
Hey.
I'm Kurt.
Hey, Kurt. How are you?
Good to meet you.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Welcome.
I can't believe we never crossed paths.
I know.
But we never go out.
They've been working for more than 20 years in this great 19th century building, nine floors up from a scruffy stretch of Broadway, full of light.
This is our world. It's the Toledo world. And we pretty much do everything in this space. We live, we work, we have about four floors. This is mostly my studio. Upstairs is Ruben's painting studio. Downstairs is production, and there's a cutting floor. It's the old dream, the American dream of doing it yourself.
I mean, it is a kind of wonderful, old-fashioned, artisanal dream to have everything under one roof. Is there any downside to that? Does it ever feel claustrophobic?
I mean, we don't live here anymore, I have to say. We lived here for about 15. We finally were able to get our space outside.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, that's how I feel. No, it's actually good because everything comes through here. And it's interesting because even Broadway, the direction of Broadway, everything is focused into this building. I mean, look at the angles of the building. It's like an arrow. And the energy comes right into this space.
So it's your own personal Cuban feng shui or something?
And you got it. And it feels good.
So you have been a designer since the 1980s and considered this designer's designer. And then 3 years ago, the wider world suddenly heard of you when you were hired by Michelle Obama to design what she would wear to her inauguration, her husband's inauguration.
It's incredible. That was a beautiful gift.
How did that happen?
She actually was a customer before. I was not hired, but I was asked to present a design for this moment. And she obviously likes my work. She's always felt that it's something she can wear, and she liked what I do. And I proposed a few different garments, and she chose one of them.
So did you think of it? I mean, given that the inauguration of any president is a piece of theater, did you think of it like that? Like this is a costume for a character in this national pageant rather than just a dress and a coat?
Yes, I did. But I thought of it as a character in a painting. And I recognized what was going to be standing behind her, which was black, blue, red. And I wanted to figure out what could I dress her in, what color. It was all about the color for me. What could I dress her on that she can pop out and she can carry the emotion that the whole country was feeling, which was that optimism. I think,
and
darn,
that,
I did a good job.
And the color you chose was?
The lemongrass, which is what I called it.
You were born in Cuba and lived there until you were eight?
8 years old.
I came here in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Were there things about your youth that sort of set you on this path?
That would set me on this path, not knowing the path, yes. The fact that I come from a large family of women. My mother had sisters, 15 of them. So I always had women around me, and the characters were something that I always found interesting, and how they all expressed themselves differently was something that I enjoyed. I imagine that's part of what makes me feel comfortable around all the role-playing that it takes to dress women.
Unlike most famous fashion designers, you aren't owned by a big multi-billion dollar company. It's just you and your
husband
and your employees. As I say, this very old-fashioned artisanal sort of approach. Other than not having a boss, what does operating in this way, which is now unusual, let you do as a designer that you couldn't otherwise?
Well, it pushes the creativity a little further. It has to be practical. It has to be marketable.
Right.
It has to be bought. A woman has to want to pay the price, and I don't have a market team behind me. I mean, I really feel that it's important that the woman connects to the garment and wants to own it forever and give it to her daughter after that. And they're not cheap.
Give me an idea. What do your clothes cost?
Probably from $800 to $10,000.
And actually, that's not... I was expecting some bigger, more shocking, eye-popping price.
No, because I don't have marketing.
Yeah.
So everything goes right back into the product.
So how does it work? You were, I guess, driven by the season, spring, fall schedule and resort wear and all that stuff. You know the deadlines, but then how do you begin designing the shmatas for that deadline?
Those shmatas are being designed day and night. First of all, I dress myself. So I'm experiencing what it is to wear what I make. It's not just the season. It literally is all the time, nonstop. I am thinking construction. I am thinking design, texture, emotion. That is what I do constantly.
That's, and then you say, oh, I kind of see it like this. And, oh, Ruben, I happen to be married to this artist. You draw it for me?
Lucky me. I probably will discuss how it anchors on my body, or I'll take the fabric and drape it around me. And then he mimics and he puts it on paper. When he draws, I always say that it's his heart and his hand at work. He doesn't process. It doesn't go through his mind. He really does connect heart and hand.
Well, let's go find him, and maybe you can show me around a little bit.
Very good. Let's do that.
So I see a sewing machine, an old sewing machine, or there's a new sewing machine.
Well, there's pretty much everything. This is my studio.
Here?
This is mostly where I play, let's call it that. I'll either play with garments, you know, draping. I'll do some sewing.
It's where experiments happen. So this is why you got to... it's a laboratory, exactly.
Yeah. And I picked it up for you, by the way. It's nice and neat.
There's a man following us now. I guess you should introduce me formally.
And this is my husband, Ruben Toledo.
Good to meet you.
How long has this
been going on?
Oh, well, a few words.
I see.
So these paper things hanging from racks are...
These are patterns. We have 4 floors worth of patterns. These are patterns going back to 1984 or before that. And some of them are just prototype patterns that we reuse and reuse and remorph into something else.
I feel like they should be in some climate-controlled thing so they don't yellow.
No, we like them to grow warts and bumps and everything. That makes a new thing happen, you know?
So these dresses on...
Pretty much all prototypes. At this point, this is a design that was done maybe 4 or 5 years ago, but I pulled it out to make it a little different because I wanted to experiment with another technique.
And I would describe that in my stupid, non-fashioning way, but you described that for me.
Oh, the starburst.
We want to hear your version of describing.
It's a party dress. It's a bluish party dress made of many layers of...
Tulle.
I was going to say tulle.
Very good.
With a lot of white dots that could be confetti. Covering it in sort of quasi-random pattern.
It is a party dress, but it really is right now a prototype.
Meaning, you know, it's
the
not
scale.
Finished.
It is not finished. No, and it's also just an idea for now. Usually it might get...
Well, that's an idea with a lot of detail.
Yes, well, that's how ideas are born. You know, you add all the details and you create a product.
Are there just fabric catalogs and I say, oh, that looks good, I'll buy a few yards of that? Or how does that work?
No, fabric mills are specialized things, you know. That's what used to be called the rag trade. They really control fashion. They invent cloth and they want designers to use them, so they come calling on you.
Oh, really?
To say, look at our new inventions. Nowadays, it used to be Americans were part of that game, but nowadays those fabrics come from France, Switzerland, Germany, almost anywhere but here.
Huh. And in that, so they really want...
Oh, yes.
Isabel,
yes. Because, in fact, I experiment a lot with their fabrics, and they are constantly looking at what I do to show my quality to someone else so that they are interested in buying their fabrics.
And, in fact, as part of the feeding that happens in fashion, what she invents now, we'll see 3 and 4 years later, they're doing that technique, but now en masse, offered done this way already.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So we keep moving on, and they keep following afterwards, and it's all a
circle.
It is.
But it must be nice, since a lot of your life is selling, to be the buyer sometimes, to be the person who they're sucking up to and trying to get to use their fabrics.
We're not buyers ourselves. We're makers. There's a real difference there. You know what I mean? Like, I think we see ourselves that way, not one or the other. Right. I think you're makers.
Right. How many hundreds of dresses do you make a year?
100? 100?
Yeah,
more.
Really? That's what we almost consider them, prototypes. 100 of these girls go out into the world.
Wow.
And encounter clients, you know?
But that must, for buyers, for clients, that must feel good to know that there are so few, that it's this limited edition thing.
I imagine it is, because that's why you could call it luxury in that sense, because remember, each one is made by hand, each one at a time.
I think you can call it luxury.
You think so?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah. I don't think it's an elitist thing. I think that's why we go to movies, or that's why we listen to music, or that's why we read a book or look at a painting, right? Sometimes you got to possess it, and sometimes you can just look at it. That's why, it's funny, fashion is this, you don't have to spend a penny to enjoy fashion. You just look at a beautiful woman wearing a beautiful design and you have just enjoyed fashion, right? And you didn't spend a penny. That's the beauty
of it. Now I know why I live in New York City.
You got it. You got it.
If somebody wants to become your client, do they apply? Well, how does that work?
Good question. That's a tough one because I tend to, since I work through the stores, they come to the
club. Barney's.
Barney's, I do Nordstrom. And in fact, having to sell it now takes away from the time I like to spend making it. So I have a great relationship with the stores because they get my work out there.
Yeah. Well, and thanks for taking the time away from making it to talk to me.
It's a pleasure. Can't wait to know how I'm going to be inspired. Ruben, do you want to say thank you?
Thank you, Ruben.
You, sir. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure.
Ruben and Isabel Toledo. Isabel's new book is called Roots of Style, and you can see a slideshow of our visit to their studio at studio360.org. Every so often, we hear from listeners about a work of art that changed their lives. Sergio Munoz is an artist who lives in L.A., but he was born in Mexico. He remembers moving to California as a kid and being terribly lonely.
At the time, I was learning to speak English. I was learning how to get along in school. And so I think when you come from a place like Mexico, which is so warm in human contact, and you come to the United States and everything is really solitary, you don't really have anybody, there's no personal relationships, at least at that time for us.
When he was 7 years old, his dad took him to a Tower Records. After flipping through the stacks of vinyl, little Sergio found Kiss's album Alive, a double LP plastered with pictures of the band in their full 70s over-the-top drag.
It's all leather, it's all studs. Ace Frehley is playing the guitar upside down. There's smoke coming from the back. I know we want to about her. I know she'll only make you cry. So the way that the LP is structured is it essentially has four panels. And the page that struck me the most, beside the cover, the left interior page, had notes from the band. So each member of the band was essentially writing a note to their fan base in their character. And so the one that impressed me the most was Gene Simmons. And it said, "I can see you from the corners of my eyes, and I know what you do when the lights go out." If you look at it from like a 7-year-old English language learner, I probably didn't understand what it was that he was saying. But instead of being frightened by it, I was actually really comforted by it. Gene Simmons would be watching over me and helping me along. When you're an immigrant family, although my parents were highly educated, you know, you don't necessarily turn to them for how best to speak English. You don't really know what to do. And so I used to imagine that Gene Simmons would come down and help me with my schoolwork. So it was this very otherworldly type of rock star that was entering into my imagination. As I grew older, Kiss remained the primary rock and roll band in my life. For me, the Kiss catalog, especially as it went through the makeup years and it went through the years when they took off their makeup and it goes into the present where they're sort of embarrassing themselves, there's still some songs that I still gravitate towards and that I still listen to on a weekly basis. Now I work as a community artist. The children that I work with when they're in middle school, they're going through this really huge transition. They aren't children anymore, but they're not adults, and they're sort of somewhere in between, and they're trying to find themselves. And so I come in as a non-authority, as an artist, to help them express themselves in their own way. It allows the child to vent about things that they think are unfair. And it gives them the confidence to know that someone's interested in their ideas. And I think it's very similar to the feeling that I had when I was flipping through all the LPs at Tower Records and I saw, this is something different. A certain level of craziness is actually something that should be pursued.
Out on the streets for a living.
Sergio Munoz is an artist in Los Angeles. You can see some of his work at our website. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story with Krista Ripple. And we want to hear about the album that changed your life. Or maybe it was a novel or a movie or a dance performance. Drop us a line at studio360.org and we'll get in touch. That's it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening. And don't forget our short fiction contest. Write a backstory about one of the three pieces of vintage junk pictured on our website, studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Thanks also to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
I think that I may be the voice of my generation.
Lena Dunham, writer, director, and star of the new HBO series Girls.
Or at least a voice of a generation.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.